You and I back together Thursday, June 17th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. Why are people fascinated suddenly with drug cartels? Is this now a substitute for our once insatiable mob and mafia fascination? We spoke to a budding author about that and his projected five-volume series on a fictional drug cartel, which could be made into a streaming service mini-series. Chris Powell joined us in the 4 o'clock hour from the Journal Inquirer of Manchester to talk about the passage of recreational marijuana in the state legislature and that infamous budget implementer bill. And our buddy, our pal on the commuter beat, Jim Cameron, in the 5 o'clock hour to kick it off. Jim Cameron writing the Getting There column for Hearst Connecticut Media. He's been having an interesting recent back and forth with the head of Metro North. The series now on all the streaming channels with all these streaming services. Now, it's great because it gives authors and TV producers and actors and playwrights a way to get more stuff out to people. And the rising wave we're seeing, even in the movies too, sometimes comically and sometimes seriously, is America's fascination with drug cartels. I finally remember the name of the movie I saw back in 2012, Savages, an Oliver Stone movie with Selma Hayek. I thought it was pretty good. The reviews were, but I thought it was pretty good. Joining us right now to talk about that, he authors the La Familia Loose Ends series, is author Corey Cepeda, who joins us on WICC. Hey, Corey, it's Paul here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Paul. Good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. You before you started writing and bringing us this whole being one of the authors to kind of highlight the drug cartel storyline, you had a kind of a rough upbringing, from what I read. Talk a little about that.
Yes, sir. So I grew up, in a single parent household. My mom worked very hard to raise a young man in the 80s and 90s. Grew up seeing very extreme amounts of domestic violence. My mother experienced a relationship in my most formative years from the ages of 7 to 14 with a man that, beat her up and punched her and kicked her and degraded her and did just about every other thing imaginable. And through all of that, adversity and fire and flames, I was able to persevere and overcome. And it really wasn't until my mid-30s that I really understood the message, the lesson for me that was to be learned. And that was really what a man is and is not, and how to treat people, how to respect those that you love, and you don't lay your hands on women ever. And, your reputation and your legacy is everything. And so, I started off very, very rough life, but was able to break that cycle and turn it around.
Did you, Corey, while this was happening and looking around you, being conflicted with this, did you see some of this cartel and gang activity and the dark side of what you write about?
No, sir. For me, I did not grow up inside any of that. And when we get to the book a little bit, here, you'll understand that it's all out of my imagination. I grew up with a family that was from the deep south, from Alabama. So I was very fortunate and blessed to grow up in a very amazing culture with food and music. And we did the church on Sundays and the amazing R&B music, the Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder and Shy Lights and Delphonics and Teddy Pendergrass. There was violence around me with this gentleman. He did sell guns and drugs, and he had a relationship with police officers, which made it very difficult for my mother to obtain any sort of protection from them. So I saw violence in a different way, not through cartels.
So that's interesting. So how then, and we'll get into this before we take a break here, Corey, how did the segue occur between you growing up in this kind of a dichotomy of an upbringing and then you're writing this series of books? How did that come about?
It really only started for me a few years ago, if you can believe it or not. I grew up with always having a very vivid imagination as an only child. You got to keep yourself occupied a lot. And I was always very, very good at word comprehension and reading and writing. But it really only came to fruition a few years ago when I just got tired of working corporate America and wanted a change. And over the years that I had worked corporate America, I had always had this idea in my mind of this story, but never did anything with it. But I would always take notes and write down things, you know, as I would see them pop in my head. And in 2019, I decided to call it quits and you know, follow my dream and passion. And I sat down on my couch one day and opened up my laptop. And I just started writing, and it didn't stop for 2 hours. And inside those 2 hours, I had my first 20 pages written. And in 3 months, the book, my very first book, was done. It just came to me that quickly. It was so organic and felt so right. I can't explain where the stories are coming from, you know, higher power or whatever you choose to call it. But it's just flowing out of me like I can't imagine.
Interesting. We'll get to the books momentarily. Corey Cepeda is the guest. Corey, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Traffic and weather together and more as we roll along right here on WICC. And we continue with author Corey Cepeda. Name of the book is La Familia Loose Ends. And a few more minutes with Corey here. Corey, why do you think, and I'm reading some of the excerpted pages here, why do you think there is this fascination that we're seeing now? We see it on the streaming series, movies coming out every so often, with essentially the drug cartel culture, the family dynamics. I mean, it's almost, Corey, kind of mafia-like. When I was growing up, we had the Godfather movies and, you know, movies like Casino and Goodfellas. You think there are similarities there? What do you think's going on?
To answer your first question, I think there's something very hypnotic and mesmerizing about, you know, a cartel. When you say cartel, to most people, there's an anxiety that goes along with that, and a very, very healthy respect that, you know, comes into play when you say cartel. You're not talking about your low-level street gang, mm-hmm. right? You're talking about a very highly organized and savage machine that instills fear in just about everyone. People want to try to understand that brutality, I think, when it comes to a cartel. Maybe you could make some comparisons on how they're organized to a mafia. They do have similar hierarchy rankings, if you will. But I think cartel lifestyle is, you know, 99% of people never get to live that, but they see that power and that influence. And in deep down, kind of a primal way, they want that level of respect. And that's not to say they want the violence that comes along with it, but they want that type of respect that comes with a cartel. So it gives people to, you know, an opportunity to live vicariously through the movies and see that extravagance and that power and that money. And there's also something very romantic about the Spanish culture, if you will. You know, it's romanticized and it's sexy, but also in the blink of an eye, it can become very violent too. You don't even need to understand Spanish to know when somebody's really in an agitated state of mind. When you can hear them talking, you know something bad is really about to happen. And that just enthralls people to want to see the tragedy unfold.
And you're talking about The Flash, and immediately I reflect back, Corey, to say the difference between how the mafia is depicted. You know, not a whole lot of flash, guys walking around in tracksuits, okay, driving a Cadillac, whatever. The stuff happens at night, they whack somebody in the back. Versus, say, a movie like Savages, or say you go back to something like Scarface, which is, I mean, the flash and the extravagance and the guns and the jewelry and the cars, that's right, as you say, Corey, right up front, right in your face.
It is, and I'll kind of fast forward a little. You know, maybe if you look at the Netflix series Narcos Mexico,
yes,
which depicts the very true life story of Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo, who kidnapped the DEA agent Kiki Camarena. That is a phenomenal series where it really isn't about the flash or the pizzazz, but it's about the connecting to the story characters and that just phenomenal actors in that. I think people just really want to connect to those stories and see how they unfold. And in the beginning, yes, that's what, you know, the world had Scarface and all of these other amazing people in the movies. But right now, I think there's just something, almost a reverence with cartels when people sit down and watch these shows.
Cory Cepeda is the guest for a few more minutes. The name of the book, La Familia Loose Ends. Check it out on Amazon. By the way, Cory, I see here that 50% of the e-book or hard copy sales are donated, it says, to fight human sex trafficking. Talk a little about that, please.
Yes, sir. So I have, myself have never had to experience the inhumanity of human sex trafficking, but I am a father of two beautiful, amazing daughters, and it would just kill me if anything ever happened to them. And I know that there are families every day that suffer this tragedy. The cartels obviously have their hands in everything. Yeah. So I figure through this work of fiction here, if I can do some good, you know, with my book sales, I would love to do that and help out people find their loved ones or help them recover from their trauma. So every hard copy book sale and every ebook sale, 50% of that is automatically going to go to help fight human sex trafficking. And each book that is released is going to go to another specific cause. So when book two comes out here shortly, that's also going to go to a cause. So every book will be themed for global reaction. And this first one, I wanted to do something that touched everyone, hopefully, and that is to help stop human sex trafficking.
Very nice. Finally, you know, I was reading some of the excerpts here, and they're really good. The book is getting great response. Where do your characters come from? I mean, I've talked to authors, Cory, over the years, and they always say part of the battle, half the battle, is developing good characters, and as you say, then just letting things flow. How did you develop these characters?
I started with what would I really like to see on TV. What have been some of the shows that have moved and motivated me? I wanted this to come from a place of conflict and sadness and anxiety. So I looked at all the shows that gave me those feelings, and then I started putting these characters together. So they're a hybrid of some real life people and then, you know, nobody. They're just people that I thought I'd like to see on a TV show. So when you look at the mother and the father, Vicente and Gabriela de los Santos, they are powerful people. They are savage cartel leaders, but they are also parents as well. Vicente, you know, is the supreme leader in Mexico, and there's really only one thing that brings him joy, and that's his daughter, Lucita, who is 10. She wants to just be a little girl and live her life, but unfortunately can't because of the violence of her family, and she becomes a, you know, unfortunate pawn in the collateral damage. They have two sons, Ignacio and Santino. Ignacio is a very brutal and barbaric lieutenant in their cartel, and he thinks that he can actually do better than his own father. So he looks to challenge his father for that power spot. So you have that old lion versus young lion. Santino has managed to stay out of the spotlight, but he's also grown up with the privilege of his family. But as he gets older, he wants to better his country with education and hospital and food and education. So he challenges his father and mother in a very different way. And then lastly, there's Aurelio, who is Vicente's brother. And he is a very powerful and smart, honest, truthful police officer in the Sinaloa State Police. And he wants to dismantle his brother's empire, but he wants to do it without destroying his family, because not all of his family is bad. So you have all of these amazing dynamics that are occurring, and you can see the tragedy is going to unfold. They're all just going to collide into each other, but you have no clue how it's going to happen. And I created these characters, like I said, just out of what I like to see this on TV. So
wow.
My answer is yes. I would love to see these characters crash into each other.
And speaking of TV, finally, Cory, have any notion, or are you maybe shopping this to all the outlets we have now, or the big screen, you know, all these channels, all these streaming services, Cory, they need programming. Have you started that yet? Come on, you got to do it.
Well, I will say I have started the pilot series for the first episode, but I don't feel I'm anywhere near ready to shop this. The second book is done and ready for release. I'm in the middle of the third book right now. I think once the third book is released, that'll be kind of my goal point, because then that really is just such a launching point for the family, if you will, for the sadness and the tragedy that's happened, that I think I could very much pitch a five-season series to hopefully people in Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime or wherever to get them to see the vision. So as it stands right now, no, I want to push the books. I want to create a platform for them. But I do have every intention on bringing this to TV someday. That is the goal.
Well, listen, if you need extras, like in the book, if there's a radio talk show host who gets hooked in the middle of this, you know, I can always, Corey, I can arrange my vacation time to fly out to wherever you are for shooting. Just want to let you know that. The name of the book, the first in a, hopefully, a series of five. One is done, two and three are coming. La Familia, Loose Ends, Corey Cepeda has been the guest. Corey, thank you. It's fascinating. Good luck, my friend, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you. All right, there you go. Hey, right? You never know. In 2 or 3 years, can you imagine that? If we're sitting here in a few years and Netflix or Hulu or Fubo or, I don't know, whoever, you know, Amazon Prime, La Familia, the hot new series about drug cartels. Gosh darn it. And I'll say, see, a couple, 3 years ago, who I had on Connecticut Today? Big deal, yes. Starting in May of next year, 2022, retail marijuana sales begin. The state Senate voting what seems like the 33rd time earlier today to finally come to an agreement with the House. The governor is all excited and a quiver about this, and that pretty much almost puts the capper on the legislative session. Chris Powell joins us, a former managing editor, still great columnist at the Manchester J.I. Chris, it's Paul, sir. How are you?
Great to be with you, Paul. Thank you.
Chris, are you all a quiver now that in about a year you'll be able to buy retail marijuana coming to a store near you, as we say in the radio business? That's
I'll manage somehow.
So much to talk about, Chris. You know, where I opened the show and I said, and we'll get to your latest column coming up as well. Boy, I got to tell you, Chris, it's amazing. We kept hearing about righting past wrongs and bad incarceration and equity here and tax money. And I was really disappointed, Chris, in at least one party, hardly if ever, bringing up possible social ills, the exacerbation of such, and just the pure medical risks of doing something like that. And, you know, it's just sad that we're still so divergent on this thing.
Well, you know, there is a way to legalize marijuana without putting state government into the marijuana business and turn it into a load of patronage, which is what the legislation does. You could just repeal the criminal laws on marijuana. I mean, everybody who's favoring legalization says it's effectively legal now because the law has been weakened on marijuana and there's very little enforcement. So, you know, why not just repeal the criminal law and make the status quo acceptable, and you don't have to put the government into the business. But I think this legislation, in the end, the real purpose of it was not to right past wrongs. It was to create a load of political patronage in the licensing of marijuana dealing. And I don't think there's any social justice in that.
Yeah, and Chris, I keep trying to wrap my arms mentally and physically around all this language about who is an equity applicant and who's not, and geographic tracts, and then there's that little change that Gary Holder Winfield and Robin Porter pulled the other night, to which, you know, half of the General Assembly said what? It's just, you know, Chris, that whole thing, it just, there's something odd about it. There's something weird. And yes, I agree with you. This, to me, and I haven't seen the exact language, but man, is this rife for corruption or what? I don't know.
Well, it's a whole new patronage system. And I think that's what its appeal was, to the Democratic majority. You know, these days they're dressing all patronage up as equity. Just call it equity, and all of a sudden it's, you know, wonderful. It's not, you know, political patronage anymore. It's not corruption anymore. It's social justice. I hope news organizations will not let them get away with that for forever. But you know, the premise here, I think, is false, that this is going to be reparations for the war on drugs. But you know, how many licenses are you really going to end up issuing? You know, maybe a couple of dozen, you know, two dozen. Well, you know, then you're going to have those people, those minority license holders, sell the drug back to their communities, which are already, you know, demoralized and poor, and this will just be, you know, more drug intoxication and addiction in communities that are, you know, already so disadvantaged. What's the equity in that?
Yeah, good question. Chris, hang on. We'll be right back with you. We're going to get your thoughts on the budget implementer in that special. Chris Powell is with us. Look for his columns. He's got a new one coming out in just a matter of days. More with Chris. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue a few minutes more on this Thursday, June 17th, with one of the most perceptive voices in the state about state policy, about what really is irking and hurting Connecticut. Chris Powell, columnist, longtime writer, former managing editor at the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. You know, Chris, I was talking to friends of mine both in the legislature and out and on social media when certain things didn't happen, and they all got back to me and they all said in some way, shape, or form, watch the implementer, watch the implementer, don't pop the champagne yet. And gosh darn it, Chris Powell, if they weren't right.
Yeah, you know, this is such an anti-democratic system that is getting worse and worse at the Capitol. This regular session ends, but they need, you know, a special piece of legislation to implement the state budget, and this implementer bill ends up catching all sorts of things that there were never public hearings on, that people, you know, probably don't support, there's no hearing on it, no debate. There's no notice for them. These things get called rats. And sure enough, the current implementer bill, which is like 800 pages long, has got quite a few rats in them. There's a provision that was never addressed during the regular session to cut off some state financial aid to towns whose schools are still using Indian mascots. There was a provision in it that I read this afternoon was taken out today, but there was a provision in it to allow State Department heads to enter contracts with other states, you know, without the approval of the legislature. That was thought to be a backdoor way to put the state into that so-called Transportation Climate Initiative, which is really just another 5 or 15 cent per gallon gas tax. You know, how do these things get into that implementer bill, you know, when nobody's watching? Well, they get into it because the legislative leadership decides to, you know, get sneaky and try to, you know, get these things past the public without the public noticing. And the irony is that I guess today the Yankee Institute said that House Speaker Matt Ritter and the Democratic Majority Leader in the House, Jason Rojas, moved to remove the contract signing provision from the implementer bill. But it couldn't have gotten into the implementer bill in the first place if the Speaker and the Majority Leader hadn't put it there. You know, so here they're posing as if they're cleaning up the government. Well, they're the ones who arranged for the rat to get into the implementer bill in the first place. And this is so anti-democratic to be passing legislation without public hearings and public notices. You know, the Republicans are somewhat on the alert for this, but God knows what else is in that bill.
Yeah, and Chris, it is sad. You're right, and things need to be debated. And I said earlier in the show, kudos to the folks at the Hearst Connecticut Media Editorial Board, the Register, the Post, and all that. Their lead editorial says debate on Native American team names needs to happen in public. And Chris, we can separate the two, right? We can say this is a testy topic for a lot of people, but as you say, you're doing it underhandedly and at the beck and call of. And this is my this is only me, Chris, not you, but I'm saying, you know, what a legislator who fancies herself, I think, as the governor of Eastern Connecticut here. I mean, who is she to say, A, this must happen? Now, maybe it would, but who knows? And B, to declare that funding from the slot machines cannot go to these cities or towns if they keep these names, which I've been told in and of itself might be patently illegal.
Well, you know, so this is Senator Kathy Austin from Sprague, whose district includes the two Indian casino tribes in eastern Connecticut. And she's certainly free to propose that legislation, but she ought to propose it in the open and have it go through the hearing process and not prevail upon the Democratic legislative leaders to sneak it into the implementer bill, just so she can show the casino Indians, you know, how much that she enjoys being their tool.
I'm sorry, Chris. That's the best line I've had this week, and I'm not even high. So Chris, this, and again, Chris, it's frustrating because you know this, I know this, a lot of your readers know this, a lot of the callers here to this station and other talk stations, outlets around the state, Chris, we try and give them a voice. But again, if people keep reelecting these 10, 15, 20, 30-year members of the General Assembly, like, for example, Senator Fon Farah the other day, who likened the death of George Floyd by a rogue policeman's knee to not raising taxes on the rich, this is unfortunately, Chris, what we're going to keep getting.
Well, you know, look, I'm going to blame the Republicans, too. I mean, we lost a lot of Republican legislators in the last election because of the backlash against President Trump. And, I know Trump's got his supporters here in Connecticut, but the disaster that is the current legislature with the huge Democratic majorities, and not only huge Democratic majorities, but huge component of far-left extreme Democrats in the legislature. That is a consequence of the Republican Party's love for Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not going to sell in Connecticut. Now, if you want a more responsible government in Connecticut, which I think, you know, means competitive politics and a Republican Party that's always in contention. Well, the Republican Party, you know, is not going to get in contention by self-destructing with Donald Trump.
Chris, thank you. Chris Powell, watch for his column this coming weekend, Rats Ride the Implementer and Presto Change Your Equity. Chris, thanks. We'll be in touch. Be good. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah, and folks, what Chris is referring to is, now whether you think it's right or not, if you go back to the 2016 election, okay, at the time, if you remember, the state Senate was split 18-18. There was a power-sharing agreement in the state Senate. The state House was the closest it had been in decades, primarily because the state Republican Party had successfully hammered the message that the Democrats were irresponsible with raising taxes over and over again. But again, that was the year Mr. Trump won and he was elected, and that's fine. But man, was there a backlash here in Connecticut, mainly by suburban women. Cameron's with us. He is our guy, writes the Getting There column for Hearst Connecticut Media. I wanted to have Jim on because, well, there was a response written to one of the things he's brought up in the past, recently penned. Jim, Paul here. Now my mics work. How are you, sir?
Hey, you got to push the red button.
Well, right? I was trying, but, you know, these.
I was feeling for you as I heard that music fade away, and I thought, oh, my worst nightmare.
Oh, God. But see, when you and I used to do this, the boards were 8 feet long, and you could keep your lunch warm on them. Now this thing in front of me is like a foot and a half wide, and it costs the size of a luxury car. And man, oh, man.
All digital.
Tell me about it. Reboot, control, alt, delete. The person that runs Metro North, Jim, has written kind of a response to you. So why don't you outline the situation here and tell us what's going on between you two?
Well, you know, I wrote my regular column, which deals with transportation issues, and you can't write about transportation in Connecticut without talking about Metro North. And the gist of my column, which ran on Monday, was that Metro North really needs to add more trains, that the ridership is coming back. I'm seeing pictures and hearing reports from commuters that are, you know, they're in some trains back in standing room only conditions. And they're wondering, where are the other trains? I mean, we're only running about 53% of the service that we had pre-COVID. And if ridership is coming back, and we have all these, you know, empty rail cars sitting around and employees looking to, you know, get back to making overtime, why aren't they running more service? So I was very pleased on Monday when my column hit the Hearst papers to suddenly see that afternoon that Metro North was announcing more train service. And I said, well, I'll take total credit for that. You know, obviously.
You're moving and shaking. Shaking the trees, yeah. Jim. Yeah.
But the president of Metro North, Ms. Catherine Rinaldi, who is a wonderful lady, and she's doing, a really good job. She wrote a letter in response to my column and had some unkind words to say about, you know, what my intentions were, et cetera. You know, I think she called me disingenuous and I had my facts wrong. And, you know, I'm a former reporter. I check my facts. Yeah, I make sure everything, you know, buttoned up. But I was flattered that she reads my column so quickly and was able to find time to pen a response.
So listen, that's good. It's good when both sides are going back and forth. So for folks who didn't read it, who didn't see her response, what exactly, Jim, was her response to what you had wondered out loud about numbers of trains and scheduling and all that? What'd she say?
Well, she said, you know, we've been working on adding more service. And as a matter of fact, next week, yes, we will be adding more trains. Four more trains on the New Haven line, big deal. But that's still only going to get us back to about 2/3 of the service we used to have. And there's nothing else planned, she said, until August, just before Labor Day. So if the ridership does come back, you know, I think the last thing, there's two things that riders don't want that's going to attract them back. One, they don't want crowding conditions. They all have to be wearing masks still. But, you know, who wants to be paying $400 a month to stand all the way to Grand Central? You know, so she's adding a few more trains. Good for her. The other thing I said in my column was that Metro North is very slow to respond. I think the phrase was they're about as nimble as a brick when it comes to, you know, making decisions. And one of the things I mentioned in my column was that there's a guy who's actually looking to start a commuter bus service from New Canaan and Darien and Greenwich to kind of skim the cream off the top, the 1% cream off the top of their ridership by offering luxury motor coaches with Wi-Fi.
Wow.
That Metro North does not have, you know, and a one seat ride all the way to Wall Street. Well, I think that frightens the railroad.
You think so? Like, really, huh? You do?
Yep. They don't want competition. I mean, they've had a monopoly all these years. And the thing that's going to encourage people to try taking the train again, and I think it's perfectly safe, is what Kelly Quinn talks about every 10 minutes. The traffic. The traffic is horrible.
Yeah.
You know, coming back out of New York City on I-95, you're in bumper-to-bumper conditions from the state line all the way up to Bridgeport. And who wants to be doing that? At least on the train or on a commuter bus, you can kick back, you can read a book, you can have a nap, you can have a brewski. But you can't do that when you're sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic. So I think that that's what's going to drive people back to trying to train again.
So, Jim, do you, as far as her response saying, well, we're going to add a few more trains maybe around August or up till August, do you think this might be, Jim Cameron, a episode here on their part of really not wanting to commit to anything? I mean, as you say, the trains are getting more packed. Okay, so what if in the next month people are breathing down each other's necks again on these trains? I mean, can they not? Are they going to say, no, we have to stick to our schedule? Or if they are they trying to say, okay, well, we'll add more now or do it quicker? I mean, could that be their thinking?
Well, that's my point. If they're as nimble as a brick, how can they make those kind of decisions? I think that they should be able to add more cars and more trains. You know, they should be looking at the ridership patterns. You know, we're seeing a real change in commutation. American Express announced this week that their employees don't have to come into the office on Monday and Friday. Just come in 3 days a week, midweek. So as they see the patterns change, I think they should be adding more cars to trains, adding more trains to the service, to reflect when people want to travel. And that should be something that they can do rather quickly. They shouldn't have to study it and model it and put it through the computers. You know, throw more cars on that train if it's one that's busy on a regular basis.
Yeah, in fact, Jim, I did see it was a major brokerage house, Jim, in New York. I forgot which one, but did you see where their boss came out? And I would imagine they have people here in Fairfield County. The boss came out the other day and said, here's the deal. You can work from home. You're going to make less money. If you come back into the city, we will give you your, you know, what we were paying you pre-COVID. But, you know, part of our team building is in the city. But, you know, you wonder, Jim, how many people may say, well, you know what? The wife or the husband or the domestic partner, they're doing well, so I'll take less money and stay off the train and not have to go into the office 5 days a week.
Well, it's nice if you have the luxury of being able to make those kind of decisions.
Yeah.
And if he needs to incentivize people with, in effect, giving them a raise or not penalizing them by, you know, working from home, people are just as productive, if not more productive, working from home.
Mm-hmm.
And they have found a quality of life that they were not finding by wasting 3 hours a day on a train and paying $450 a month for a commutation pass. So, yeah, you're not going to pay me as much, but I'm not going to have to spend as much money on Metro North and on the subway and lunches in the city, et cetera, and the aggravation. Yeah, I'll still work from home and maybe make a little less money. I mean, this is something I predicted back in December, which did not make Ms. Rinaldi very happy then. I did not get a Christmas card from her this year. when I predicted that commutation was not going to return to normal.
Wow.
That ruined my entire Christmas holiday. I was distraught.
Wow, you're on a roll today, Jim. You know, we do have listeners in New York City. I can tell you that. They listen. Jim Cameron. Jim writes the Getting There column for Hearst Connecticut Media. Jim, thank you for straightening this out. It was good fun, and we'll talk. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, Paul. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Old Jim Cameron there, the commuter advocate, writes the Getting There column for Hearst Connecticut Media.